Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 42. I'm your host, Michael Shoebridge from Strategic Analysis Australia, and this recording is brought to you from the SAA Global Bunker deep in the Brindabellas, and I'm with Dr. Marcus Hellyer, our head of research.
Hello, Michael. Episode 42, the meaning of life episode. All will be revealed, I'm sure. Well, it's great to be back in the bunker. We had a busy week down in Tasmania doing the sea trials on the China Zaria, the world's largest salt.
Zaria was a great ship, but I tell you what, I'm exhausted. I carried so much duty free off that thing, and I could, the excess luggage
had to carry
getting
you back to the bunker. But here we are. And look, my inbox is full, and I have a message here from a Mr. Kim in Pyongyang, and he has heard about our expertise in maritime engineering. He's got a problem, salvage problem up there in North Korea, wants us to come in. He's going to make us an offer we can't refuse to come and help him out with his maritime salvage problem.
Well, look, a lot of people say bad things about Kim Jong-un. I tell you what, he's a hell of a leader. That man drives accountability in his system.
If only we had that in our Defense Department.
He's found that this 5,000-ton new destroyer, second one in its class, that accidentally got dropped on its bottom.
Crushed bottom?
Yes, it's got a crushed bottom, which is very bad if you're a destroyer. It impedes your performance. Was because of a criminal act that involved unscientific empiricism.
I hate unscientific empiricism. That's why he wants us to bring some scientific empiricism, I guess.
If the grumpy strategists are anything, we are scientific empiricists. So he's called the right people. And look, it's a high risk, high reward scenario. So I said, I'm all in. I'm on the plane.
All right. If you're going to go, I'll go too. How long can it take? We should be back pretty quickly. I mean,
look,
nothing could really go wrong, could it?
A crushed bottom is a problem we've all dealt with. So I think, you know, this is just a bigger five.
I do have to say, we didn't do so well trying to salvage the Norwegian frigate that ran aground. I mean, some problems are just too big to fix.
Look, that was a learning exercise. Mr. Kim would not have called us if he didn't think we're up to it.
I agree.
Now, this is a bit of a grab bag. So, yes, it is a Life, the Universe and Everything episode. I think we're going to do a bit of a drone and capability update, touch on a groundbreaking, backward-looking Australian National Audit Office report into defence's industry policy, talk a little bit about the bigliest airstrike in all of history, and just there's a slight product warning there that is not true, and maybe just talk a little bit about the way China has used the India-Pakistan conflict, a bit like the Germans used the Spanish Civil War as a bit of a road testing for its capability.
And I think also, before we sign off, maybe just a few quick words about the MRH Shiny Crash Inquiry, because a very thorough and detailed, and I think pretty objective report has come out.
Well, why don't we do that now? Of course, okay. I think that's current. It was a tragedy, three lives lost, or four lives lost. And now the accident investigation is complete. I think it's good for airworthiness and air safety that has been released, and it looks a pretty thorough report. The primary cause?
The investigation concluded, quote, that the primary cause of the accident was an unrecognized loss of spatial orientation, commonly referred to as spatial disorientation. What does that mean? Unrecognized spatial disorientation occurs when a pilot misperceives the orientation or position of their aircraft with reference to the surrounding environment. This leads the pilot to take actions that are relative to their misperceived orientation and without awareness that the aircraft is in an abnormal state.
Yeah.
So the aviation safety investigation was absolutely scrupulous in not assigning blame, but I think in common English, you would have to say that this is pilot error. There was a failure of the aircraft. They the top OWL helmet and the helmet-mounted display has been in the news a bit. They actually say that as far as they could tell, that played no role. So it was essentially the pilots losing track of where they were in space. They were flying at night. There was rain. They couldn't see the horizon.
Yep.
They were trying to stay in formation with three other helicopters, so they're trying to track those other helicopters.
The side doors were closed, so the other members of the crew couldn't help with that orientation. These, in aircraft crash history, this disorientation is a primary cause of air accidents. And The report also talks about a bunch of other contributing factors, some procedural and policy problems within Army aviation. It talks about things like the load on all of the personnel involved, not just in operating, but also mm-hmm. in planning and
fatigue
conducting
seems to have
operation.
Played a role. So there were a lot of work was done in the investigation into fatigue.
But the idea that the aircraft was dangerous and not fit for service is not supported by this investigation at all.
Not really, other than the fact that the report does say one of the contributing findings was the sort of the overall load on Army aviation of not only operating the MRH-90, which was quite a complex aircraft, but also starting the transition to what was coming next. But there was nothing about the aircraft per se. So it is one of those sort of unfortunate situations, well, very unfortunate that four Australians service people were killed. It's sort of, I think, you know, was the final straw in the government's kind of confidence in the MRH-90 system. And so the government grounded it permanently before we had a mature replacement. And we're still living in that capability gap. We're not going to have the full Black Hawk capability until the end of this.
And you wonder what that does with all those supporting enabling systems and processes and the human training and proficiency by turning off the type-out machine before you get the other one in any kind of numbers.
It's very hard maintaining skills in the best case, but when you don't actually have helicopters to operate, it's even harder to maintain skills.
I would say that idea that, well, you know, this was a complex capability and therefore it put a load on everybody, well, that is a problem that everything about the forward investment plan of the defense organization is doubling down on and making worse. Everything is becoming more complex to operate and maintain. So if we think of this accident investigation report as showing that complexity can be a problem, well, that's a bigger issue for defense to think about.
I think it also raises that issue that has always been around of who should actually operate Army aviation. Can you actually operate these complex systems in a relatively small organization? So it is a subsection of the Army dealing with very complex systems, and you don't really have the critical mass. And so that's one reason why originally the Air Force operated helicopters mm-hmm. that were used by the Army. So I guess this is going to be one of those issues that the pendulum swings backwards and forwards. And I haven't heard this time round a lot of voices publicly saying, well, maybe
calling to move it back.
Maybe it is a busted flush. The Army shouldn't be operating helicopters. But I know speaking offline, particularly to Air Force people, saying, well, the Air Force does this really well. So maybe Air Force should be the organization operating rotary wing capabilities for the ADF.
Well, yes. Anyway, a tragedy for the families and friends and the individuals that were killed. But I do think it shows these were functioning helicopters. And if we were getting rid of them, maybe we should have given them to the Ukrainians instead of rapidly cut them up and stuck them in holes like we wanted to forget about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, drone update. There is quite a bit here. I was at something, Williams Foundation last week. You were there too. You presented. I just sat back and watched. There are a bunch of people there saying, oh, this drone thing, it's exaggerated, you know, doesn't get around all the problems of complex integration. All it does is disaggregate your weapons and your sensors, and therefore you've got all these extra vulnerabilities because you've got all these communication links you've got to maintain. Well, I don't think that the Ukrainians are listening because they seem to keep having success even with quite long-range drones. So today, there's reporting of multiple Ukrainian drones reaching 1,200 kilometers into Russia to destroy one of Russia's main Shahed drone manufacturing facilities.
So they're using drones to destroy a drone manufacturing
facility. It's a counter-drone. The long-range drone attack is a counter-drone strategy because they're destroying the drone manufacturing.
I'll just insert a little editorial comment here. If you think the best way to destroy drones is to kill the factory that's making them, and that also applies to traditional crewed systems, the best way to do ASW, anti-submarine warfare, is not let the submarine go to sea in the first place. It's
well,
to destroy it in port.
This is an interesting new, we haven't confirmed this reporting yet, but a very credible Ukrainian official has said publicly that Ukraine has unmanned underwater vessels that it's used to fire missiles from to destroy Russian aircraft.
Yeah, I'd be interesting to see confirmation of that because, as we've said before, what's going on in Ukraine is if you can imagine the effect, you can do it. And so we've seen this progression of Ukrainian uncrewed service vessels kamikaze into ships and essentially have driven the Russian Navy from the Black Sea. But we've also seen them use uncrewed service vessels to launch missiles to shoot down helicopters. They do seem to have shot down fighter jets from uncrewed service vessels. And they've also conducted land strike, firing munitions to take out Russian air defense systems on land. So all of those things we've seen. So the next step you may imagine is, well, can you do it from underwater drones? And it seems like it's happening. So all of those things, it's not just future technology. I got an email recently from the Australian Naval Institute putting out a call for contributions for their next conference. And one of the topics they wanted to talk about was drones. And it's one of the question was, well, what kind of capability could plausibly exist by 2030? I'm going, well, maybe you might want to look at what capability actually exists right now. Because we've said this many times, Michael, this is not science fiction. It exists here right now. Now, what doesn't exist is drones that can be a one-for-one, like-for-like replacement for your traditional crew systems. Why did you raise
this? Because this was a big theme that, again, came out at the Williams Foundation from a number of speakers last week. It was saying, look, all this stuff, you know, again, about drones and uncrewed systems, what it fails to understand is you can't replace your exquisite high-end system with these cheap alternatives. And the problem with that is you don't have to want to replace your exquisite high-end complex system with something else. In fact, you might just want something really cheap that is designed for one purpose, a long-range strike to destroy a factory. And so you may not integrate it with everything and have all of the functionality that you have with this exquisite complex force. So there's an imagination problem with the way the conversation around these new systems and weapons is being conducted here in Australia.
So we know tanks obsolete now. Well, I don't know if tanks are obsolete now based on what we've seen in Ukraine, but what we have seen is that cheap first-person view drones have made life very difficult for tanks, and you need to use tanks in a fundamentally different way. So it is changing. You cannot deny it that it has changed.
That probably gets us on. Other militaries think changes that we're seeing in these current wars are relevant to them, and they're experimenting with some of the ideas. So think about this as a list of countries right now that are experimenting with armed, unmanned aerial vehicles flying off naval ships. They're either building the ships or they're
light carriers. It's the classic light carrier concept, but using uncrewed systems.
So the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Singaporeans, and the Turks, they're all experimenting with unmanned combat aerial vehicles from things that look like small aircraft carriers. And in fact, the Turks are using a Spanish-designed LHD, Canberra-Adelaide design, but they're willing to say, look, there's a role for armed drones taking off and landing on this. And of course, they have the advantage that their government has invested in Turkish-manufactured unmanned combat aerial vehicles, and they have successfully taken off and landed from that LHD.
Which have been battle-tested in many theatres,
and currently
in Pakistan and
Now, let me say something obvious. If you've got drones you can launch and recover from an LHD, you extend the range of those unmanned systems by the range of the ship. And that is relevant to the Indo-Pacific. Think about a drone like the Ukrainians have, 1,200-kilometer strike range, operating from an LHD.
Well, yes, and that was always the argument for 35B. So the short takeoff and vertical land version of the F-35 is that you extend the range of it by the range of the ship. And that was what people thought the Koreans were going to do.
The South Koreans were doing that.
They were going to do that, but they seem to be saying it's not worth the effort. Something as complex as F-35B, we can get similar effect through cheap and cheerful drones.
Well, and they're going to save billions of dollars. So by not having to design the ship to support F-35Bs and not having to buy F-35Bs, they're going to save billions of dollars. That's part of their plan too.
But, you know, we can give these drone updates. The problem is that things are happening so fast and at such scale around the world, except in Australia, that it's really hard to keep up.
The Pakistan conflict is a really good example. I think it shows, look, you still want your high-end systems, you want your advanced fighters, your long-range air-to-air missiles and air-to-surface missiles, cruise missiles, and advanced radar systems and air defense systems, but you need to wrap them up with a whole bunch of cheap and cheerful and quite capable drones as well. The thing about the India-Pakistan conflict is both sides had those. And so the Indians had, they had some older Mirage fighters. They had the brand new Rafale fighters, also French. They had Scalp missiles, French missiles to destroy ground targets. They had Hammer glide bombs. They had Israeli loitering munitions, and they had their own BrahMos missiles. So they had a high-low capability mix, if you want to think about that, the exquisite and the small, smart and the many. And they had Russian S-400 air defense systems. Well, the Pakistanis had a similar Orbat, just from different manufacturers. So they had some joint-designed Pakistani-Chinese jets, but they also had the JL-10, the more advanced Chinese, J-10, the EL-15E, very long range, very capable air-to-air missile. And they had the Chinese air defense radar. I never realized
you were such a techno fanboy, Michael. I mean, this stuff is just rolling off your lips. I'm stunned. I thought you regarded you as a big picture strategy guy.
Well, I'm just saying, if you look at just their orders of battle, they had pretty sophisticated, advanced, high-end and low-end systems. And the result was both of them took significant combat losses, including of some of their most advanced stuff. So the Pakistanis seem to have lost some of their pretty expensive Chinese air defense systems on the ground, and they lost numerous drones on both sides. And the Indians probably lost at least one, maybe two or more of their new Rafale fighter jets.
Yeah. When I look at it, you can draw a few conclusions. First is it's really, really hard to know what's going on. So extravagant claims and counterclaims have been made. So the Pakistanis were saying they'd shot down five brand new Rafale jets.
Plus a Heron UAV, they said.
And the Indians have made claims that they've killed two of the Pakistani AWACS, these Saab AWACS systems.
And caused major damage to Pakistani bases.
Yep. One in the air and one on the ground. Who knows? So truth is the first casualty. That's not really new news. But the other thing is the kinds of kill ratios that we've seen from the Middle East, where the Israelis using Western, primarily American and Israeli equipment, have racked up these incredible kill ratios over the Syrians and over the Iranians. We're not seeing that in the Indo-Pakistan conflict. The kinds of kill ratios of Western versus non-Western systems, we're not seeing there. Partly because the Indians and Pakistanis are both using mixes of Western and non-Western, but it does seem to be the case that the Pakistanis have shot down Indian jets using Chinese jets and Chinese missiles. So I think the first takeaway to consider there is, you know, those kinds of traditional kill ratios that you've seen in the Middle East, you're not going to see in, say, a Pacific conflict between US and allied systems on the one hand and Chinese systems on the other side.
That's right.
You know, you are going to take losses.
And if you're going to take combat losses, not like the ones we've seen in the wars of discretion of the last 30 years, but actual combat losses like we saw in major wars, Vietnam, probably, North Korea, the Korean War, and of course the Second World War, you need to be able to replace the combat losses. Mm-hmm. And both the Indians and the Pakistanis have some rebuilding to do.
So on that issue of replacing combat losses, I think, you know, one of the things we can see is that with its industrial capacity, China is actually better placed. The US and its allies won World War II because it outbuilt the bad guys. The shoe is now on the other foot, and we can see that in a number of places. So let's talk about something that's been in the news a bit. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but it's the Shui Chow class landing barges. And there's, you know, been some tantalizing footage on the internet of these new landing barges that the Chinese have been experimenting with. There's been a really good study out of the China Maritime Studies Institute.
Yes, it is
part of the US Naval War College, sort of unpacking
this. Tom Sugar is one of the authors of that, and he brought the story out.
And so there's these massive barges, and they work as a kind of little crew of three, 110-meter one, 135-meter one, and 185-meter one, and they work together to create essentially this huge pier, and roll-on, roll-off craft can plug into this big, long pier and land vehicles.
Well, the study says they can form an 120-meter composite relocatable pier. And these are being built by a company called the China State Shipbuilding Corporation. It's offshore and defense arm. And that, to me, is one of the most interesting things, because Chinese naval shipbuilding is conducted by Chinese companies that do commercial engineering and shipbuilding as well.
China is the largest commercial shipbuilder in the world. And so, yes, they can leverage that capability.
And so they've brought those lessons from their offshore engineering and design arm to this naval problem, an amphibious landing problem. Because I think you were mentioning that the way the legs on these floating piers, that the barges work, they jack themselves down like an offshore exploration rig. So it's the same engineering.
Really floating per se. To me, what's really fascinating about this is we saw during the Israel-Gaza conflict, the US tried to bring relief into Gaza by setting up a floating pier.
Yeah.
And it was a massive failure. Like, it broke three times because of sea states before they gave up. Now, the US is meant to be the gold standard in amphibious operations, and yet they couldn't really even set up a floating pier in an uncontested environment. Meanwhile, the Chinese are going, well, we'll go one better. We'll have this huge
relocatable
landing barge system. Now, is it going to work? I mean, who knows? I mean, if you're a targeteer, you go, there's one big, nice floating
I'm getting myself
target.
A fixed target.
Yep. I can take out with my guided munitions. So, you know, it doesn't guarantee that the Chinese can invade Taiwan. But I think it does show essentially the ability that the Chinese can draw on from their civil sector. When they have this huge civil shipbuilding industry, they can do this kind of experimentation.
Well, let me guess that the China State Shipbuilding Corporation's Offshore and Defense Division is not doing this on a couple of $100,000 grant with no path to acquisition if it works, unlike here in Australia. So the experimentation, I think, is really something to pay attention to, because it's very practical experimentation. I think there's another Chinese outfit building a different version of this same capability. And we could tell ourselves stories. We could say, well, look, you know, the weather in the Taiwan Straits means this will be like the Mulberry Harbour during D-Day. It'll get washed away, or like the US pier in Gaza. But
the Mulberry Harbours that the Allies used in D-Day, they worked long enough.
Well, they did the job for the time.
They worked
long
enough.
In fact, the study is a very good study that you mentioned of this new potential capability. But it says, actually, there's a big problem with this capability, because if it works, they're going to put so much stuff ashore that there'll be horrible traffic congestion on the beachheads, and that'll be a big problem for them. Well, I think it's a problem the PLA would love to have.
It's a good problem to have. But another really interesting study out of the China Maritime Studies Institute also has pointed out that in the first 2 months of 2025, there has been more PLA Navy vessel activity around Taiwan than ever before. So more ships off Taiwan than ever before.
More aircraft. Yep. Well, the extraordinary thing about this is that is not a global news story. There's a tiny little blips of reporting of Chinese military presence around Taiwan. There's quite a bit about the kind of intimidation that's still happening against the Philippines and the very violent behavior of Chinese maritime militia and Coast Guard vessels. But this growing physical presence around Taiwan has been just crowded out by, you know, the Trump circus, the war in Ukraine, happening still in Gaza.
Well, it's funny you mention Trump, because there's an analogy here. People go, well, we don't know if Trump is a Russian Manchurian candidate inserted into the US government, but everything he's doing is consistent with him being a Manchurian candidate. And when I look at these reports on what China is doing in terms of amphibious capability and activity off Taiwan, it's like, well, we don't know if Xi Jinping has decided whether he's going to launch an amphibious invasion of Taiwan, but everything the PLA is doing is consistent with developing the capability to actually pull it off.
Well, you know, back in the DIB era of Australian defence planning, there was a lot of weight on, look, you've got capability intent, you know, and intent. You've got you either have or don't have the capability to do something, and that should be discernible by intelligence and analysis. But intent, that's unpredictable. You might have an intent to do something, you might not, but capability is the measure. Well, unfortunately, in the case of Taiwan, the government in Beijing has the intent. It wants to unify Taiwan with the mainland, and it's happy to re-educate the 23.5 million Taiwanese as part of that.
Yeah.
Government officials have said that, and consistently. And Xi Jinping talks about the historic mission to unify Taiwan. But the PLA capability piece, as you say, they're building the capability.
Well, you don't need to be the world's greatest analyst to put two and two together here, because actually Xi Jinping has told the PLA to be ready to do this.
And they're doing what he said.
And this is what it looks like on the ground. These are the sorts of things you would see.
Yeah. So while the rest of the world is sleeping because we're preoccupied with so many other things, China is proceeding down this path, and that's a very dangerous path for the world. Now, let's not forget the Australian National Audit Office. They just did a report on the Department of Defence's industry policy and its implementation of its industry policy in its procurement actions. And the short version is, measured by its own policy, its own industry policy, defence has failed because it has failed to incorporate its own policy, not the broader Commonwealth procurement policy, its own industry policy, into its own procurement documentation.
But it's industry policy around Australian content. That's the key thing here, is that the Australian government has had policies which have flowed into the Department of Defence about seeking Australian industry content, and then once a contract is issued to a
monitoring prime, the achievement.
Monitoring the delivery of that. Every time you and I go to any kind of event, Michael, we meet people from Australian industry who raise the same issue that, you know, big contracts are not including Australian content, and the content that is meant to be there, there's no following up on that. Well, we see here from the ANAO that that's not just the kind of anecdotal feeling of Australian companies, but that's actually the fact on the ground.
Well, it's a systemic problem is what this ANAO report says. It says defence is not including its own industry requirements into its contracting. When it, even if it has them, it's not monitoring the achievement of those through the course of the procurement.
Now,
so that's two own goals.
Now, I don't want to be too critical of the ANAO and our friends there who do fantastic work, but there is always a bit of an element in their reports about, it's all about process. Defence states its processes, and did it actually follow its processes? There's always this assumption in ANAO reports that if defence follows its processes, you'll get a good outcome.
All good things happen.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's the case, but one of the problems with ANAO reports is we don't really get an assessment of what was the actual outcome. And here we don't actually get any data about how much Australian industry content is there in these contracts. Now, in ANAO's defence, if defence isn't actually tracking this, it's not going to have the data. So again, I don't want to be too hard on the ANAO. But again, we've got a report that is about process, but we're not actually getting any real data.
Yeah. Look, I often feel, and I like the work the ANAO does, but I often feel like they're the victim of that problem of the blindfolded person trying to work out what the thing is that they're grabbing hold of, and it's an elephant, and all they can do is grab a bit of the rear leg. You know, you need to get the big picture of what's actually happening here. And the problem is that government policy is not being implemented, and it's not being measured, so it can't be evaluated, and so you don't know what's happening. That is the problem.
So when
someone like Pat Conroy says, oh, you know, the statistics show there's an amazing spend on Aussie industry and defence, I don't know what they're all complaining about. Well, they're not collecting the data in their own contracts.
Well, I'll give you a little anecdote on what this looks like on the ground. So I was at an event last week, an event essentially looking at AUKUS Pillar 2, so the AUKUS stuff that's not nuclear-powered submarines, looking at AUKUS Pillar 2, trying to work out what actually is it. And we have these you know, existential ontological conversations about AUKUS Pillar 2 all
the
time.
Well, you tell me what colour it is.
You know, and then discussion about what's it actually delivered. Well, I'll tell you, what does it actually look like on the ground? Sitting next to me was a gentleman who had his own SME, his small company working in the defence sector. They've essentially just gone to the wall because, you know, and they are working in the core of AUKUS Pillar 2 territory. They've just gone to the wall because there's no money has been coming through from defence. So, you know, that's, we can have ANAO reports, which are all nice, and they give us the big picture. But on the ground, what does it actually look like? Australian companies are going to the wall because no money is flowing out of defence to actually support Australian companies and acquire their products.
My assessment is, from this ANAO report, there is not a will in defence to implement a credible industry policy. Because if there was the will, the behaviour that you see in this report would not be occurring.
I agree 100%.
Now, speaking of other militaries, this isn't a drone update, and it's not the Houthis, but turns out while the Americans were sailing around near Yemen, they were also doing something on the other side over in Africa. In fact, I think it was the acting chief of naval operations in the US.
Yes, the acting chief, because Trump fired the actual chief for being a woman, I think.
The acting chief has got in on the bigliness shtick. He's claimed that the Americans launched the biggest airstrike in history, with 70 tons of ordnance being launched from, I think, the USS Truman against ISIS in Somalia.
It's good to see US military leaders taking their rhetorical cues from Donald Trump, where everything is the biggest, the most beautiful, you know, the bigliest ever. So, yes, for some reason, the acting CNO decided to describe a fairly routine airstrike from the USS Truman as the biggest airstrike in history, and his staff have sort of had to sort of progressively backpedal since then to say what he was actually thinking when he said that.
He actually meant it was quite a busy time on board one aircraft carrier for a few minutes there. And the result of the bigliest airstrike in all of history, I think, was 14 people in Somalia were killed. So I don't know. I think historians might say things like the firebombing of Tokyo, the bombing of Dresden, the dropping of the atomic bombs, or even some of the air offensives against Pacific Islands during the Pacific War were biglier than this airstrike.
But I mean, we're now on the topic of gaslighting in America, of people kind of retrospectively making stuff up. And so the big topic of gaslighting at the moment is Biden's health.
Oh, that's good. I thought you were going to talk about energy policy, but you mean sort of
gas is where it's at, Michael.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, interestingly, the Japanese apparently have onsold more Australian gas than Australia itself has used. This is what the mega geniuses who run Australia have delivered us. You've triggered me, Michael, because you mentioned gas.
If
we should not reserve any gas, if sell it to the Japanese to onsell to make money.
If we're dumb enough to sell all of our gas on the international market then buy it back at the highest price on the international market, we deserve sensible people like the Dutch taking advantage
been
of
run by
it.
Morons.
So gaslighting. I would call this a cover-up. I mean, there's a series of books coming out now. Mm-hmm. One's called Original Sin. Mm-hmm. Doing some pretty deep investigative work about Biden's health and cognitive capacity during his last term.
And who knew what when? What did they do about it?
And they were nursing him through the last term of his presidency. They were down to about he was good for about 4 hours a day towards the end, and maybe for quite a long period of time. And they were rationing out that time extremely carefully. And they were just props all around him. This had to have been known by a large number of the members of the cabinet and all of the staff that wrap around and organize things at the White House.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that members of his cabinet are now saying, I didn't really notice.
It was always good when I saw him.
You know, that means a couple of things. Either you weren't really paying attention, or you're just making shit up now, you're gaslighting us, or this was so carefully managed that even his cabinet really had no access to the president. So what are his cabinet actually doing?
Well, I think they were off with full autonomy to do what they did, to make good things happen. And remember, that was a big part of Biden. He really did let his cabinet do their jobs. And he was very non-interventionist. Well, it turns out this might be a reason why, but I think it's a very big continuing political problem for the
Democrats. It's a problem for the Democrats. It's a huge problem for the Democrats.
Well, it's a massive reputational hit, because it kind of says, look, the elites wrapped around the top level of the Democratic Party concealed things from the American people. And they did it because it was the right thing to do. You know, we're doing the wrong thing for all the right reasons. Well, every criminal in jail has told themselves that. You know, I'm just robbing this bank because I need to look after my kiddies. You know, doing the wrong thing for all the right reasons is not going to help them with their reputational damage.
It reinforces the marker line that Washington is an unaccountable swamp.
All of that.
You've got the deep state. You know, you got all of these insiders trying to hang on and act in their own interests. So I think it's incredibly damaging.
It's handed a massive hammer.
Democrats.
It's handed a massive hammer to the Republicans. And it's a hammer the Democrats made to get themselves hit over the head.
Plus anybody who was part of that. And so members of Biden's cabinet may say, well, I didn't know. Well, the question is, well, either you're covering it up, you're gaslighting us, or you're incompetent because you couldn't see what was going on. So any member of Biden's cabinet, I think, is now tainted for the next presidential election.
They really are damaged if they want to be presidential contenders, because if you're one of their opponents in the primaries, you're going to be hammering them on that. So tell me, did you know President Biden was incapable of doing his job? And if you did know, why didn't you do anything about it? Why didn't you tell the American people? Why did you have the fiction he was okay and support him running again? And if you didn't know, well, you're asleep at the wheel. There's no way you should be president. So there's no way out. It completely blasts open the potential field of who might be the Democrat presidential contender.
And even if you go, well, this is really a problem with Biden's staff, you know, that they concealed this. I don't think you can somehow, you know, quarantine it and say, but the rest of the Democrat Party
is fine.
I think it just it opens the Democrats up to charges that they are unaccountable, not acting in the best interests of the country. You know, this whole slew of charges. So Trump will massively capitalize.
Yes. But think about Roosevelt, Reagan. There's two US presidents I can think of without thinking much. I think they both had major health troubles that were concealed from the American people. Ronald Reagan, I think, cognitive decline in his last term. Roosevelt had polio and concealed it from the American people. So these things had.
It's like Reagan, obviously he couldn't run for a third time, but it would be like Reagan running for a third term in his state.
Anyway, it just is more of the mess that we see the American political system as in. And I think a big lesson out of this is come clean with your population. Don't do the wrong thing for what you think are the right reasons.
So it's you know, the Democrat Party will eventually recover, I guess, but, you know, it's been very hard for them to recover, and, you know, a lot of people in America, you know, I have friends in America who were saying one of the hardest things about the current situation is they just can't see the Democrats pulling their act together and fighting back against Trump. Well, this is going to set them back.
A whole lot more infighting. You know, in Australia, I suppose we look at the disarray in the coalition parties. They're lucky because the Democrats are in worse shape. Well, Marcus, that's a very cheery note to end this on, but I think it's where we've got to. So I'm going to secure the bunker and just do all the cybersecurity checks around this podcast.
Yes, I just want one call out. I think we like to congratulate Aussie industry when it does
something good.
And so Burden, an Australian company with a very healthy American subsidiary, started production on two prototypes of landing craft for the US Marine Corps. So good to see an Aussie company doing well in America. And I will just say that this is not their first US contract. I mean, Burden in the US has had a long string of big contracts for the US Army, for bridging boats. They've had contracts with the US Coast Guard. So they're going great guns in the US. So,
so it's good to see their land craft design being picked up here finally. But it's another example, isn't it, of the sort of myopia that Canberra has about Australian firms. In all the stuff for years and years about naval shipbuilding, Burden was never in this picture. And yet, like Incat, they appear to build a bunch of things that are useful to others.
That the world likes.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Marcus.
Great. Thank you, Michael.